Thank you. Good afternoon, everyone. When we were putting together the session, we had a method to our madness. We figured we'll start with the big picture, with the big data sets, and then start drilling down to some of the specific chronic conditions and different patient populations. And also, the presentation I'm about to share with you also brings the qualitative element to our conversation. As many of you might have noticed, the government is actually becoming especially interested in hearing from the patients, from the patient populations. PCORI is a great example of that effort within the federal government. And our study actually was funded by the Center for Medicaid and Medicare Services, and one of our specific charges was to precisely document some of the patient voices when it comes to medication adherence. So this will be a more qualitative approach to asking some of the same questions that we're asking: what's going on with our patient population? I wish I did, but I don't have the financial conflicts of interest to disclose. So when we talk about medication adherence, those of you who've been around the block a while might recall this as being referred to as compliance. We used to talk about compliance, patient compliance, but that has recently, in the last few decades, I would say, actually fallen out of vogue. Now we talk about medication adherence. And in a nutshell, there are three main components to medication adherence. Are our patients taking the right dose? Right? Are they taking it at the right time? And are they taking it with the right frequency? So those are the main three components of medication adherence. And there has been much research done on the barriers to medication adherence. And we can look at them primarily across four categories, one of them being systematic barriers, drug shortages being one of them. If there's a shortage of heparin, our patients won't be able to be on heparin therapies because there's just none to be had, antibiotics, penicillin, right? And cost, obviously, if our patients are falling through the Medicaid drug, the donut hole, the so-called donut hole, they don't have insurance, it's just too expensive, they have competing priorities for their budget, they're not going to be able to take their medications as indicated by their healthcare providers. Knowledge. Now, when we talk about medication adherence and knowledge, literature primarily tends to focus on knowledge of the patient and the health, and the family. Do they know what to take, how to take it? But we're finding that healthcare providers are not uniformly educated on what to prescribe, how to prescribe, what's the right dose, how they should be indicating it. And Dr. Peterson kindly mentioned that I'm in the Indiana Prescription Drug Abuse Task Force. One of the things we're finding out is, for instance, our primary care physicians don't necessarily know how and when and under what doses and which population to prescribe opioids to. So we have systematic issues around medication adherence that really transcend the patient and the family. And then patient attitudes, obviously. You might have encountered patients, those of you who are healthcare providers, who have a certain level of fatalism, and they say, I'm going to die anyway. Why am I taking this, right? There's no use to it, or it doesn't work for me. I have side effects. So instead of engaging in a conversation with their healthcare providers, they choose not to take the medication in the first place. And behavior. We see that our patients who are frequent flyers, who have shift workers, who have even irregular meal times, who have never developed the habit of eating at a certain time, have a more difficult time adhering to their medications. So what can we do to help these people? They have chronic conditions. They have sometimes multiple chronic conditions. It's not unusual for our patients to be on 8, 10, 9 different medications, right? Just counted 8, 10, 9 on multiple medications. And as a healthcare system, as the public, what can we do to help some of our fellow citizens and some of our patients stick to their medications so they're taking the right dose at the right frequency at the right time? One of our hypotheses going into this research was that perhaps the use of an electronic personal health record, which I will refer to as an EPHR for the remainder of the presentation, might help our patients stick to their medications. Just out of curiosity, show of hands, how many of you are familiar with what EPHRs are? How many of you have your own EPHR record? Just for the benefit of the rest of you, one person had their hand up. I have one. And for those of you who may not be familiar with what an EPHR is, the electronic personal health record is the patient-facing portrait or portal into a patient's medical record. So when we talk about EMRs, we're talking about what the healthcare provider, what the health system sees. But when we're talking about an EPHR, we're talking about what our patients see, what we're allowing the patients to see, the view that we're allowing them into their own medical records. So our curiosity then was, if our patients had access to at least a glimpse of their own medical record that we as healthcare providers see, will that impact their willingness to stick to their medication or their ability to stick to their medications? We also wanted to find out what features of the electronic personal health record the patients find particularly helpful for sticking to their medications. For background information, there is really nothing, no such thing as an EPHR out of the box. All EPHRs are sold by vendors. At last count, there are about 800 EPHRs out there. So unlike if I were to ask you how many of you are using Microsoft Office Word, and we would more or less agree on what Microsoft Word looks like and feels like and what the features are, EPHR marketplace is completely different. One EPHR looks nothing like the next 799 of them. So we wanted to begin understanding what works. Spending all this much time and effort implementing EPHRs. What does it look like? What should it look like? What's helpful? And then we also wanted to look at what are some of the specific barriers to both the use of EPHRs and also barriers to a positive medication adherence, including adherence to their prescription regimens. So this is a picture of the EPHR portal or entry page that we're using. The health system that we are working with is using. It's by Epic, right? So the big company Epic. This is their patient-facing portal of their EMR, right? And we wanted to look at atrial fibrillation patients, who I will refer to as AFib patients, because it's less of a tongue twister. AFib is very prevalent. According to some estimates, those over age 80, 10% of those over age 80 will or do suffer from it. And going back to Dr. Sripi Patana's presentation, we know that by the time our patients reach a certain age, especially age 80 and over, they're very likely to have other morbidities as well. So atrial fibrillation tends to be a comorbidity in the elderly population, but it's not uncommon for a younger population to suffer from it as well. And for all of us, there's a 1 in 4 lifetime chance of developing atrial fibrillation. And this is why CMS was particularly interested in it, because a lot of the patients who are under Medicare and Medicaid are suffering from atrial fibrillation. And if you're not on your blood thinners, there's a very high likelihood that you're going to either suffer from an embolism or you're going to suffer from a stroke. So the costs are tremendous associated with AFib. So there are two, well, the mainstay, the traditional best practice gold standard therapy for AFib is warfarin. And warfarin, one brand name for warfarin is Coumadin. So if you hear about Coumadin therapy or warfarin therapy, they're the same thing. And the point to warfarin therapy is that we want the blood not to clot as much. So if there isn't as much clotting, then the people are less likely to suffer from a stroke or an embolism. Unfortunately, with warfarin, one of the drawbacks is that it requires frequent monitoring. And what I mean by frequent monitoring is literally making a visit to the doctor's office as frequently as twice a week for some patients to have their blood drawn and then to look at something called the INR. And to adjust the dosage of warfarin, sometimes as frequently as every week, so that their clotting values stay within therapeutic range. So you can imagine being on warfarin therapy is a tremendous burden of time and resources and effort for the patient and might have implications for medication adherence. And there are also dietary restrictions because it works on the vitamin K-dependent clotting mechanism. Patients cannot or are not supposed to consume foods rich in vitamin K, including spinach and kale and cranberry juice. These are some of the different Coumadin or warfarin tablets. Because the medication dosage sometimes needs to be adjusted very frequently, the tablets are different colors, and that's supposed to be a visual cue to the patient that they're right on the right dosage. So by contrast, in 2011, FDA approved a new medication called Dabigatran. This is the generic name. And then the brand name is Perdexa. So if you hear Dabigatran or Perdexa, they're the same thing. And the beautiful thing about it, we thought at the time, is that it eliminates frequent monitoring. Right? No longer the visits to the doctor's office on a weekly basis to have your INRs established. There are no dietary restrictions. It has a short half-life, so this is sort of on the con side. It has a very short half-life, therefore patients need to take it twice a day to maintain that same level of control throughout the day. And therefore, patients with poor compliance to begin with, so those who are already struggling with staying on warfarin, are not indicated or good candidates for taking this medication because now you're increasing their burden twice. Another possible drawback to Perdexa or Dabigatran is that it needs to be stored in its original package. And one of the difficulties with that is, especially those patients who are on multiple medications, what do they use? They use those little pill boxes, right? They cannot, or they're not supposed to put them into the pill box because removing the Perdexa or the Dabigatran from its original storage potentially compromises the effectiveness of the medication. It's very humidity sensitive. And it's more expensive. It's about economic studies have estimated to be as high as $7 a day as compared to warfarin, which runs about $50 a year. So there's a tremendous cost difference between Dabigatran versus warfarin. And at least as of the writing of this study that I'm referring to, it was not on all insurance formularies. So what we did was we took a patient population. We recruited 200 patients suffering from non-valvular atrial fibrillation, AFib, who were seen at a cardiology practice in Northeast Indiana. And all the patients, now when we wrote the proposal for the study and then it got approved, we had a really nice control group going because we were going to give access to half the group to their EPHR and half the group wouldn't have access to EPHR. And because the proposal time period, CMS being CMS, took so long, it took about 2 years, by the time we got around to the approval, everyone, the health system decided everyone was going to have access to their electronic personal health record, which made the qualitative aspect of the study even more interesting. So I'm going to talk about two different sets of findings. We had findings, these are the focus group findings that I'm sharing with you. We had findings related to clinical practice. So one thing that was really interesting was that patients do not get necessarily diagnosed when they need to be diagnosed, and they don't necessarily always know that there might be something wrong with them. We had many individuals who thought that what they were suffering was nothing unusual, that they thought they were out of shape, that they were just getting old, that they had pneumonia, that they had had a long work week or a long year, and they were just tired. Okay, this is a heart condition. And the symptoms of AFib are not consistent across patients, from patient to patient. Some don't feel any symptoms whatsoever, and some patients report that they can actually put their hands on their chest and they can feel their heart skipping beats or actually beating against the chest wall. So it makes it very difficult from a public health perspective to have a campaign that's going to say, watch out for these signs, because the signs are not homogeneous. I think I skipped one. Okay. We also came across patients who were entirely asymptomatic. They had no symptoms whatsoever. And this is a very big implication for medication adherence, because many patients in our study group confessed to taking their medications on faith alone, because they don't suffer from any symptoms, therefore they don't notice any improvement in their conditions when they are on the medication versus not. They also complained uniformly that the healthcare system does not share information with them. I thought this was very telling. One of our participants said, physicians put truths in a soft box. And patients really wanted to know what was wrong with them. They wanted to know their diagnosis. They wanted to know the potential consequences of side effects. They wanted to know their prognosis. And they expressed the frustration with the healthcare system, their unwillingness to share the truth as they saw it. So one implication of this finding that many of the patients are asymptomatic is that really going back to preventive care, the importance of their checkups, some of these things are not going to be caught unless we really encourage people to have their annual physical exams, if not more frequently after a certain age, because they're asymptomatic. We discuss with them their reasons for poor adherence. And a few things came up. It turns out those individuals who were switched from warfarin to Pradaxa to dabigatran actually suffered from medication adherence or lack of medication adherence, because with the warfarin monitoring, they had an incentive to stay on it because they were going to have their blood drawn every single week. And now they were on their own. So they confessed to this being left on their own to try to stick with their medication. They started experimenting. They confessed to experimenting with cutting the dose back down on their own. And some people actually apparently are taking themselves off the therapy because, again, they don't suffer any improvement in their conditions. So some people start cutting their pills. And they also talked about stigma and peer pressure. Like, they don't want to take their pills because if they want to take it twice a day, it's in the middle of the work day, what are people going to say about me? And some families are skeptical about the medications because, especially for people with multiple chronic conditions who are taking 8, 9, 10, up to 25 different medications, right? Their families are saying, don't take all those. Just take the ones you need, right? You decide which are the ones you need. And another thing that we found is that patients are not familiar with patient assistance programs. They complain about not being able to afford their medications, but the healthcare system is not telling them that there are ways to get their medications at a discounted price. So they're going without them. One of the reasons for that is many of our patients, again, it's a 200-patient population, right? They talked about using mail-order pharmacies, and they're entirely bypassing the pharmacist. And in the absence of that communication between the patient and the pharmacist, the mail-order company is not telling them, by the way, this medication is really expensive, but do you know that there is a patient assistance program that can actually cut the cost for you? So that's really interesting, and I think that has great policy implications for us that we could discuss as a follow-up. And they're contradictory beliefs. They don't know how the medication is supposed to work, right? Some people said, I know it works because I no longer bruise. And some people said, I know it works because I no longer bruise more easily, right? Same medication, different beliefs, because they think the blood thinner is supposed to work a certain way. So findings related to the EPHR. They said that they need a reason to use the EPHR. Just because there's attractive, sexy advertising out there for EPHR, they're not going to take the time to create a login, create a password, and log in. And they liked having lab results available. We created 6 newsletters. They really appreciated having the newsletters. It was a value add. And they liked the ability that they could request refills, prescription refills through the EPHR. There were some points of displeasure. They didn't know who was updating their information. If there was misinformation, they didn't know who needed to be updating it. They didn't know who had access to it. I see it, but does my physician see it? Was a very common question that was coming up. So some points of clarification that came out of our study. Again, we need to clarify with our patients, what is the purpose of the EPHR? How does it work? Where does the information come from? Do their physicians outside the healthcare system see their information? One question that we got repeatedly was, I see some of my lab results, but I don't see the other lab results. And the healthcare system is putting an embargo on certain lab results that they consider to be controversial because they don't want the patient to panic too much. But they have never explained to the patient that you won't see that lab result, but you'll see the next lab result. So again, we need to communicate more clearly. So as a conclusion, EPHR is a tremendous opportunity for patient education, as we found out with our newsletters. People read the newsletters, and we could keep track of that. They actually took the time to read the newsletters, and they learned a lot. They learned about storage of dabigatran, for instance. They knew not to take it out of the blister packs or the original storage. There are technical issues, process issues, And obviously the biggest one is systematic barriers to adherence. Unless we do something about people being able to remove the stigma somehow around multiple chronic conditions, unless we reduce the cost of the system, it's really, to a certain extent, it's still not going to make a difference whether they have a reliable information to good, a reliable access to information or not. They still won't be able to take their medications. Here are some of our acknowledgments, and then I'll be, if I have any time, I'll be happy to answer any questions. I have no time.